Thank you so much, Alan. And I just was reminded of a show that 60 Minutes did some months ago with Leslie Stahl, and she visited the missile silos out in the Dakotas and Colorado, etc. They're still using floppy disks to launch. Did you know that? Floppy disks, not up-to-date computers, and often their telephones don't work. I was going to ask Leslie Stahl come and speak, but she was unavailable. So a fascinating panel, and we're ready for questions. You know the stages of grief, shock and disbelief, followed by depression, followed by anger. It's the angry phase that'll save the planet. And I know it's not appropriate in America to be angry, except if you just shoot people on the highway, but anger is a very elemental part of human survival, fight and flight. That's why we've got an adrenal medulla, cortex. Where's adrenaline produced? Medulla. What? In the medulla. You spoke of the catastrophic danger posed by the use of nuclear weapons, and I'd like to ask you what to do to avert this risk. Reagan's 1983 proposal for a strategic defense initiative was for cooperation with the USSR on new techniques to defend against missiles, including from other states. Didn't Dmitry Rogozin revive this in 2011 with his proposal for a strategic defense of Earth, including against asteroids? Your thoughts?
I don't know about defending the Earth. I mean, the question is, who are we defending the Earth from? Maybe the people who are defending it. The problem of strategic defense is a very significant political problem. In fact, I'll be speaking in Washington in 3 or 4 days on this problem. The Russians have made it very clear that there will be no future arms reductions if the United States continues to ignore their concerns about American missile defense programs. Now, we have a very a seemingly contradictory situation, because I would argue, and I think there are many, I know many Russian scientists who would agree, that the current strategic defense capabilities essentially don't exist. They're a myth. The real problem is that when you look at the strategic defense from the point of view of a potential adversary, you can't ignore them. I often give the experience, describe my own personal experience when I was working in the Pentagon as a scientific advisor for the Chief of Naval Operations. I was reviewing the situation with regard to the Russian defense of Moscow. That's a completely different defense from the kinds of things we're talking about today, nuclear-armed interceptors and, multiple radars, things of that type. And it was very clear to me that this defense had essentially no capability. But my reaction, because technology by itself doesn't tell you the story, you have to think about the social and political implications of how technology interfaces with human society. My first reaction was, does the Russian political leadership really think that this system has some capability? If you worked in the Pentagon as I did, you would be painfully aware that high-level decision makers often know less than a person who reads the newspaper carefully. And I don't mean this in a pejorative way. It's just the way the structure of the organization is. And so it's not impossible that political leaders at the highest levels actually don't know that strategic defense in Moscow doesn't work. You can't rule that out. So then I ask myself, well, what might they do if there were a crisis, if they believed that they had some defensive capabilities in this system? Could this alter their behavior? It's unknowable what could happen, but if it altered their behavior, could this precipitate a nuclear strikes because of inadvertent actions on one side or the other? Mistakes, differences in perception. Anyone who looks at the the circumstances that led up to World War One. You don't need to even do that. I mean, leaders never have the kind of information that people assume that they would. My joke with political scientists, American political scientists, is it's not a field, it's a joke, because they have all these games. They took game theory, rational. I said, you can't have a rational game if you don't have the information on which to make rational judgments. But anyway, I don't think defense is the answer, both socially and politically. And technically, it's not feasible. So it's a clean issue. It's not like questions about global climate change, where there are all these subtleties, which are important, but you know, there are knowns and unknowns, things like that. It's really a very clear, clean-cut issue that defenses really have no constructive role to play. In fact, they're very dangerous.
Thanks, Ted.
I'd like to defend global warming theory. There's no question that humans are causing global warming.
Just wanted to add one thing to what you both said there. I think, in short, the two things we should push for are those two knobs I had on my little cartoon. We should turn them both. We should take the X explosive power, and by trying to reduce everybody to 200 warheads for a start, that would be great. That way, even if we screw up, at least there'll be less nuclear winter. And second, we should try to really turn down the P knob. And there will be a lot of discussions here at the meeting of how what we can try to do to push the superpowers from backing off from hair trigger alert, for example, which is, again, totally unnecessary for mutual assured destruction.
And it's not mutual assured destruction, it's self-assured destruction.
Yeah.
If country A attacks country B and country B doesn't do anything, the climate change will kill everybody in country A. So you can't have a first strike against Russia and survive. So that's something all people also don't realize.
More mutually assured suicide, sort of.
Yeah. If you say, I want to have nuclear deterrence, you're a suicide bomber.
Okay, people who are using Twitter use hash Caldecott Symposium. Now, this is for Max Tegmark. In view of AI systems taking over without human input, how dangerous and likely is the possibility of hackers taking control of the systems to launch nuclear war, or taking control of the decision to launch nuclear war?
That's a good question. I think... Of course, it's very hard to say and make any realistic forecasts about what happens if we get very advanced AI, human level or beyond, but we don't even have to talk about that to feel seriously worried. We just have to look at what we have now and what we're definitely going to have in the next few years. Just like you, Theodore, pointed out that we often greatly overestimate the knowledge that our leaders have in the political and military sphere, and just like we routinely overestimate their... the rationality of the decisions that are made. I think, speaking now as a physics professor and technical person, I think we also greatly overestimate the robustness of the technical systems we build. The computer security we have generally is pathetic, right? Look at what happens with billion-dollar companies who really want to protect their intellectual property, how easily they fall prey to hacks done by very poorly funded groups, right? It would be very naive to think today that the world's nuclear systems are completely immune to any kind of hacking. It would be a big joke. And then, I think it's something we should obviously worry about. And if we can't even produce... You know, I feel I probably know more about computers than your average U.S. citizen. I really don't want my MIT computers to be hacked, so I put a lot of effort into security and used very... basic Linux stuff, you know, turning all the fancy features off. Even Linux turned out to have this pathetic bug in it, the bash bug, you know. So, which just revealed, we have a very, very weak computer security. And I think one of the things we really need to do, both to safeguard the nuclear programs and more generally to prepare for what's coming, where computers playing larger and larger roles in society, is to actually put much more research into how we can actually make computers that we can trust.
I don't think you'll ever be able to do that.
No, but if we can't trust them, then we shouldn't put them in charge of respirators or other really life-critical systems, of course, let alone nuclear systems.
Why are people working on AI then? Why are people continuing to work on AI when people like you and Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking are so worried? Why are people continuing to work on it?
It's valuable, yeah. It would be naive of us to think that the technological progress that people make huge amounts of money from is just going to stop.
So it's
like
valuable
that.
In terms of money.
Yes. So I think, I don't think it's realistic for us to think that AI development is suddenly going to stop. I think a more constructive way to think about this is we are witnessing a race, as with any technology, between, on one hand, the growing capability of AI, on the other hand, the wisdom with which we use it and the robustness of the systems. And in fact, it's much easier, instead of trying to slow down technical progress where there's so much money to be made, it's much easier to try to accelerate the development of wisdom in the field because there's almost no money spent on that. That's why we launched this big program together with Elon Musk just last month to really engage the smartest researchers in the field to think about not just how can they make AI systems that are more capable, but how can they make AI systems which actually do what you want them to do, that are robust and beneficial. And we're very happy with the response of this big push. We have this grants competition where people around the world can compete for $10 million to start doing this. The deadline is actually on Sunday night. I just came back from the biggest annual AI conference of the year in Austin, Texas, the AAAI meeting, where for the first time they were openly discussing these issues in all sorts of ways. Stuart Russell, one of the grand old men of the field, gave a very passionate talk about how they need to redefine the whole goal of artificial intelligence from simply the goal of making intelligent machines to actually making intelligent machines that are beneficial for humanity. And I think that what we should really try to push for there in the short term is simply to establish this culture of social responsibility in that community. And I think that is something we are actually witnessing now gradually, which is a small step in the right direction.
So I'll just interject. I read recently that there are 1,000 legitimate hackings into the Pentagon system per day. And I've got a grandson aged 16 whose frontal lobe is not very well developed. And you wouldn't trust he and his mates at all to do anything. And they're often very intelligent, these kids. And is it possible, and I've asked another computer specialist this, could they develop a way to hack into the early warning system? Because they might think it's a hell of a hoot to, you know, blow up the world at this age. They need a bit of stimulation. What do you answer for that?
I mean, I think the only responsible answer is that I don't have a clue.
Yeah.
I think people who operate these systems are really very cautious. I think it's a mistake to characterize the people who operate these systems, both on the American and the Russian side, and I've met people in both both systems. They understand that anything that happens could result in the end of the world as we all know it. They do understand that. They also are soldiers, and their job is to provide military force should their leadership ask them to do that. So they have this tension in their responsibilities. But I think it is not correct to think of them as just sort of sitting there eagerly waiting for their opportunity to press the button. I think Mr. Petrov's heroic efforts are not unique. I'm not trying to diminish his contribution because he paid dearly for it. But there are a lot of people in the system who really do care, who really worry about this. Having said this, this in no way should make you more comfortable. I'm not assuring you, I want to be clear, I'm not assuring you that it can't happen. I'm just saying that it's a very complex question to make a judgment about.
Would it be fair to say that Mr. Petrov's job no longer exists and has been replaced by a computer so that this information would automatically be relayed upwards to the highest command?
It may be so, but I think there is a lot of automated stuff, but it ultimately goes to human beings who have to make a judgment. So, for example, this false alert in 1995, which I think was very serious. And just to be clear, at that time I had intelligence clearances, and I went into the Pentagon and
talk about the Norwegian rocket.
The Norwegian rocket. I went into the Pentagon and explained to them what happened, because I reviewed the intelligence they had on it, and they had no intelligence. So the U.S. intelligence system had failed to analyze this and understand it. So I consider this very serious for many reasons. But I also know that, as I've talked to Russians literally in the chain of command, that they were, of course, obviously very concerned, and but nobody was rushing to launch forces. And I'm sure, in fact, I speculated on this, and they later confirmed this, that when the Norwegian rocket was first observed, it fit a certain pattern, which we analyzed in detail, but we need not worry about for here, that set off an automated alert. I'm sure there was a routine in the computer monitoring system, set off an automated alert. I wouldn't be surprised if the people at the radar at Oleanogorsk didn't even know the automated alert went off, but the people in Moscow did. But the data would have been presented to them. They would have considered the situation. And of course, the great danger was they couldn't look at the early warning satellite data because they had none. Of course, the other danger is that people think they can fight and win nuclear war. So it's a very complicated set of issues here. But I don't think we should think of these people as just nuts trying to look for an opportunity.
Yeah, but it's.
But
not
I'm not
those...
arguing it isn't a great danger. I mean, I've spent a large part of my life worrying about it.
What about the fact that over 70 missile officers over the last year and their commanders-in-chief, two of them, have been fired because they've been inappropriate in Moscow, or they've been taking drugs, or they've been cheating, or go to sleep on the job. And it's not very sexy now to sit at a missile bank and decide whether or not to blow up the planet. What about that, human fallibility?
I think maintaining a high-quality manning of our nuclear forces, particularly American nuclear forces, is a tremendous problem that they will not be able to solve. It's a dead end for your career as a military officer. If you're a military officer and you're bright and you're ambitious, you don't want to go and sit in an underground silo. So they don't get the highest quality people. I don't mean to this in a pejorative way for these people. I think they're very dedicated. But they don't get the kind of talent that they've gotten in the past, because people in the past have felt that they were doing something in the nation's best interest. And now these people feel like they're in the backwoods. And, you know, just like any professional area, these people who have more mobility choose different positions. And I think these forces are horrendously more dangerous than they were earlier, when they were very dangerous then. So I think, so it's a real problem.
I think, just to summarize this important question, I mean, it's obvious that the status quo is untenable in the long term. It's just this incredibly complicated system, and once in a while some really unusual sequence of events comes together and something bad happens. That was, of course, the premise of Dr. Strangelove, as we heard about. Just make the analogy with people in this country. Every week, people accidentally shoot their five-year-old daughter because they think it's a burglar or something like that. These are not people who want to do that. They often have a lot of safeguards, but there's some really weird, if you have a lot of people, a lot of incidents once in a while, really unfortunate situation happens. And the only responsible thing to do for us as a species is to change the status quo and really reduce the power of our arsenals and reduce this probability.
Thank you. A question for Alan Robock. For comparison, how many Hiroshima-sized detonations would start the global climate impact?
We did a simulation of 100 Hiroshima-sized weapons, which would be about half of the current arsenals of India and Pakistan, and we calculated what the climate response would be. We also did, we were sort of concerned, we put 5 million tons of smoke in the atmosphere. We also did a calculation of 1 million tons of smoke, 20% of that, and we got about 20% of the climate response. If you start putting a lot more, it's not linear. The more smoke doesn't the climate response doesn't increase proportionally, because once you block out a certain amount of sun, you put more smoke up there, there's not any sun left to block out. People have asked me, you know, so, okay, so can we fight a war with 17 and not worry about climate change? How many do we... So we haven't done that calculation. If you want to do more very small numbers, then you have to know what the weather is that day, what the specific target is, whether the wind is blowing, whether the, we assume the area in the city would burn would be the same as what burned in Hiroshima, because that's the only example we have. The Nagasaki bomb was in a valley, so less of it burned. But if there was a wind blowing and it propagated through a much larger city, you could get a lot more smoke just from one bomb. So we haven't done that analysis. The other thing is, it's very hard to imagine a situation where only a few nuclear weapons would be used and it wouldn't escalate. Once somebody's attacked, the tendency is to retaliate. To you lose communication, you panic, and I don't know of any sort of. It's not rational to use nuclear weapons in the first place, but I don't know of any other rational scenarios where you can have limited nuclear war and only use a few and then not have it propagate. So. Indeed, if there was one terrorist attack on a city of the United States, it would be a terrible tragedy, but it wouldn't produce global climate change. So there's a certain amount of smoke goes up, produces more climate change. So we haven't answered that question, but I don't think it's a scenario people should plan for.
Thank you. This is an important one, and I'll throw it open to the panel, but I also probably should answer it as a physician. Musk, Hawking et al. Claim that the future of life depends on colonizing space. But does that promote abandoning stewardship of Earth in future generations in a self-fulfilling prophecy? How can we promote a cosmic perspective of life in the universe? Who wants to go?
Let me just say one thing. You know, Carl Sagan spent a lot of his life trying to figure out whether there's life in outer space, and the answer is, as Max said, there's no evidence yet of it. And there's this Drake equation, which multiplies the number of stars times the number of planets times the probability that they develop technology and so forth. And Carl thought maybe, you know, there have been technology that developed in the past, but once they get to the point of being able to build nuclear weapons, they pretty soon destroy themselves, and we don't hear from them again. So we don't have any data on that, but we know that we could do it ourselves. And so I would rather spend a lot more effort trying to fix things here than send a few people into outer space. That just doesn't seem like a rational way to solve the problem.
Let me add to that, so it liven things up so you don't feel that we necessarily agree on absolutely everything here on the panel also. The devil's advocate point of view would be that if we've made a backup of our biosphere by having some people on another planet, we would be more reckless about this one. In my personal experience, talking with astronauts whom I know, it's exactly the opposite. Everybody I know who has actually been at the International Space Station, for instance, has felt not, oh, wow, I don't worry about Earth now anymore. But rather, really just, they described it to me as a profoundly life-changing experience, where when they look down at Earth, this fragile little planet and this stark, inhospitable space, they really, really start thinking global, thinking that, wow, we really need to be good stewards of this amazing planet that we have. And to me, the much more powerful effect is that if you get people even thinking about space in the first place, even thinking about the long-term future of humanity, even thinking about the future of life beyond the next election cycle, that already will reduce the risk of voting for politicians who do really stupid things here on Earth. And So I'm all for encouraging people to think big and also think about the long-term future. In terms of money, it's also important to remember that the amount of money we actually spend on science, the amount of money Elon Musk spends trying to plan for a Mars program, etc., is absolutely puny compared to how much money we spend on building this system for destroying life on Earth with nukes. Now, the entire funding for all of mathematics and physics in the United States in a year from the National Science Foundation is about $2 million. It's about the same as the military spends in a day, in one day, okay? So don't come and tell me that, oh, by cutting the science visionaries a little bit, somehow that's going to somehow make life so much better. Let's just if you cut the military by 1/3%, it would have the same effect. We shouldn't take the various idealists and try to pit them against each other by saying, you know, no, the idealists who want to stop nuclear war should duke it out against the idealists who want life to flourish in space and fight over the pennies, when there are such enormous amounts of resources instead being spent on our nuclear weapons program and other things. That's my two cents.
Okay.
I'm sorry, but I agree with you.
I'll speak as a physician now. Humans cannot survive in space. If they're up in space without gravity for too long, their muscles turn to tissue paper, their tendons split and fall apart, the bones demineralize, they can become psychotic with loneliness, their blood pressure falls. Humans cannot exist in space without gravity. So let's wipe out the whole notion of going to other planets and spending any money on that at all. Let's fix this planet. Ted Postel, does Russia actually have a dead hand system that would respond to a nuclear attack if its command and control system were destroyed and if Moscow was decapitated?
Well, I think, again, this is one of those questions where I have to answer, I have no idea. But let me explain to you why I think there may be something like this, although I'm only speculating. We do know for a fact that the Russian leadership does believe that there could be an attempt to decapitate leadership in Moscow.
Describe what decapitation means.
Basically that the United States, as part of an attack against Russia, would aim at destroying the political leadership of Russia. The idea, again, thinking again of conventionalizing nuclear war with conventional objectives, as if that's possible. You destroy the leadership, the command structure breaks down, they may not be able to respond to your attack. You may be able to destroy lots of forces before anything happens in return. So you want to destroy the leadership within this bizarre framework of thinking. But they are acutely aware of it. That I can say for sure. I've had many private discussions with Russian people in leadership roles. Because of that, and because of the short time they have, because they're limited to only radar early warning, they don't have space-based early warning, there are probably, in fact, I can't say for sure, but I'm almost certain that there are what might be called pre-delegated situations. So you're manning the nuclear forces. I'm not sure I'm going to be here to execute or to give you an order. So I say, if A, B, C, and D happens, you're on your own. You can launch the forces. So I pre-delegate
to
the decision making. To some gentle one-star office, one-star general who thinks that the Americans ought to be destroyed. You know.
Well, Valery Yarenich, you know, Valery Yarenich, the Russian scientist, developed the dead hand system, and he wrote a book about it. And I got to know Valery very well, and they've dug a huge cave in the Ural Mountains, and they have this rocket which can be sent up if Moscow is decapitated, which sends a signal to all their missiles to be launched before America kills their missiles.
Yeah, but we had similar things. We had IRCS.
Oh?
You know what IRCS? Emergency Rocket Communication System, where we were going to launch. I mean, these are, these are there are a variety of provisions to assure that forces could be launched. The problem that is most serious is that, in fact, is strongly related to the artificial intelligence problem that's been raised, is that you have to set up protocols. If you believe that you have to respond, then you must set up protocols for the launch of the forces if you're not going to be in a position to order it.
If you're dead.
I'm not arguing for this. I'm just saying this is if you have this belief system. And it would be the height of recklessness to assume that the Russians haven't made some kinds of provisions, probably with a lot of checks and balances in them. But as we know, complex situations have failure modes that we can't know about. That's when you get your blue screen or whatever else.
Well, we know that in medicine too.
Yeah.
We sometimes.
So I would say it might in essence be a dead hand system, but it might not be as simple as people picture it to be. And we may have something similar. You know, we pre-delegated authority to a Strategic Air Command one-star general flying over the ICBM fields under certain conditions during the Cold War. So we had a similar system.
Yeah, I'll just bring up this point that during the Cold War, planes were always in the air, American planes armed with nuclear weapons, ready to go over to Russia to bomb them if they got the message. And the pilots had to wear a patch over one eye because when they blew up their bomb, they would be blinded so that they could take the patch off after the explosions and be able to fly home, except when they flew home, there would be no airports to land in because they would all be destroyed. Furthermore, as we know from Alan Robock's work with volcanoes and the like, planes cannot fly through volcanic ash and dust because it gets sucked into the jet engine and they crash, nor can they fly after a nuclear war because of all the smoke and ash. Just thought I'd include that. That was all planned. I was involved with anti-nuclear activism before and after June 12, 1982. Activism dropped after the march as though we'd won. What's happened to activism? Why? How do we move forward? There you are. Go for it.
First, I want to compliment you on doing one of the things which is incredibly powerful, which is simply bringing new explosive facts to the table. I think that anybody who is a scientist or has knowledge which can be used to better make the case, you should really never underestimate how much power that might have. You know, the insights that nuclear winter was as terrible as it was, you know, wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for scientists like yourself. And I think if everybody on the planet was as informed about what we already know as you in this room are, we wouldn't be in this bad situation either.
How do we get people to pay attention when they have more immediate concerns with life? They think the Cold War is over, they don't have to worry about it, and they think the possibility is remoter, they just don't know about it. How do you... One day I got an email, the Cubans would like you to come to... talk about nuclear winter, and I went down there. They paid for it, and Fidel Castro walked into the room and sat there and listened to my hour-long talk. And after he said, "Can we televise it?" And I said, "Yes." And next day, I was walking around Havana, and we went into in prime time. It was on national television. We went into a bar, a hotel where there's a TV, and there was a Julia Roberts movie on the TV. And I asked the bartender, could you change the channel? And sure enough, there I was giving my lecture. So what that taught me is we need a movie with Julia Roberts, not a professor giving a lecture to get people's attention. We need to get it into the... We need this movie with a beautiful Russian scientist who falls in love with an American scientist, and they're trying to warn the world, and there's of course some sex in there, and then along the Kashmir border, and you can imagine sort of making a real thriller to inform people. But if there are any screenwriters out there, I think that's the way to get people involved, not these sort of dry scientific lectures.
Well, the media is determining the fate of the Earth.
Media.
The media is determining the fate of the Earth, including Rupert Murdoch, who is an Australian and who created my career back in 71 when I lobbied
against... I'm sorry to tell you this, Alan, but you're not as good looking as Julia Roberts.
Wait a minute, you've got to listen to me. The media is determining the fate of the earth. If the average Joe Sixpack doesn't understand what we're talking about today, and if they just put these three speakers on television, on Stewart and Ma and Colbert and 60 Minutes and all the rest, Fox, the average Joe Sixpack and Mrs. Joe Sixpack would understand the population would rise up to abolish nuclear weapons. That's the only way we can do it. So these people have to be on television. And to get on television, you go to the top producer, you go to the director. Always go to the top. And we've got to be aggressive and demand that they put these people on, otherwise we're doomed.
Some friends of mine have suggested that there be a movie about my work, but I told them Jonathan Winters was already dead, so he couldn't play me. So, I think that we do have a very serious chicken and egg problem, and I don't like to sound like I'm using simple-minded rhetoric, but if you go to Washington and you move in the inner circles of Washington, and they occasionally let me in, not often, but what one is struck by is what a bubble the place is and what an echo chamber it is. And people, it's like people who pick up a telephone and they always hear a dial tone and they think that everything naturally works. I always explain, that's not the natural world. Usually you pick up the telephone in the real world and nothing's happening. You have a group of people who think they know a lot more than they do, and anybody who raises a question about that is naive because you don't understand the world the way they do. And it's extremely difficult at this time to get anybody in a leadership position to acknowledge anything of substance and have a substantive discussion with them. I'm not a sociologist, but I think some good sociology would be a very interesting thing to apply to this problem, because I experience it, but I don't quite understand its sources. But if something is not done to alter this situation, we're in trouble for so many reasons that it's hard to believe. So there's a problem of leadership here.
I have a question for all of you, which is a follow-up to Helen's question, actually. I think that I completely agree with you. Julia Roberts looks a lot better than we do. But there are a significant number of even very famous actors who really care a lot about this. Morgan Freeman is even part of our organization. And my question for all of you is, we have a lot of people in this room. You guys, we have Union of Concerned Scientists, Federation of American Scientists, Bulletin of American Scientists, and Center for Global Catastrophic Risk, and many, many others, I'm not going to list you all, who have thought a lot about specific things we can push for, specific battles we can pick. And what is the single lowest hanging fruit, the one first battle that we would like to try to rally whenever we get an opportunity to get one of these actors to really help us out or to get a really big media splash? What is the first thing, the lowest hanging fruit? It's not abolish all nuclear weapons, because that's higher up in the fruit tree, right? What is the first thing?
Trigger alert.
But if suppose you do, what is the particular battle we should pick first? No, but I mean, what policy goal? Huh?
Yeah, take the weapons off high alert.
U.S. unilaterally taking US weapons off high alert.
Yeah, I talked to Rose Gottmiller a year ago, who's President Obama's nuclear advisor. I said, why can't Obama just reduce the U.S. nuclear arsenal? We don't need an agreement with Russia to do that. How can we tell Iran not to make weapons when we keep ours? It's like you're sitting in a bar telling people not to drink. Why don't you set an example? We can't do that. She didn't understand the concept. We can't do that. We need it to be verifiable. I said, but George H.W. Bush did it. Oh, that was different. So it's really hard to get these people to even understand this concept. But the first thing is just to make the world safer, so that these accidents are much harder to happen.
Okay, with this enigma,
I have a comment here.
We are now disappointed. Oh, do you want one more?
I myself am not a fan of de-alerting because there are lots of issues around what you're actually doing. How do I know it's de-alerted? But I do think Alan is right. There are things that can be done. The United States could just decide, the president could, well, I think the political system won't let them, to be frank, but we could just declare that we are dissembling our ICBM force. We would still have a lot of strike capability, more than we need, and still be dangerous. We could lower the alert rates of submarines, and that would be a signal. Now, what happened under George H.W. Bush is he just unilaterally said, we are not going to put nuclear-armed cruise missiles on ships and attack submarines. And Gorbachev responded in kind. So I don't, you know, if you have some leadership, you can do things, substantive things.
We've got to end now because time is short. I want to make another announcement. We'll have a lovely morning and morning tea and coffee, but we're playing a film on the beach at 4 o'clock. I don't want any of you to leave. I'm going to lock the doors, even if you have to go to the bathroom, because we can talk about nuclear weapons till the cows come home, numbers, technologies, but I want you to feel it in your gut. And that's a film that turned me on when I was 17. It was set in my hometown, Melbourne. And everyone died except people in Melbourne. And then everyone did die. So I want you to feel this. Very ordinary people facing extinction. I want you to feel it and understand emotionally in your right brain and your midbrain and maybe your basal gang. No, anyway. So understand what this is about. And it's not just about numbers, figures and technology. It's about us and our passions.